Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home. Those boys.
That's. Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. I want to walk up.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to need it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down Swanfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
It was, as the old cliche goes, a feast of football this weekend, and such was the soccer smorgasbord over the last few days that it put me in mind of one of the most famous meals of them all. Yes, that's right, Ken. Goldilocks and her sickening porridge addiction. Pep Guardiola's tactical porridge on Saturday night was just too fresh, too hot. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer tried unsuccessfully to reheat basically the same team he's been serving up for the past 3 months last night, but Hansi Flick's bowl of Bayern roughage on Friday night was just right. You're very welcome to today's football show. Hello there, Ked.
Kieran, how are you?
I'm good. That was a very entertaining, dare I say it, very funny weekend of football, encompassing Bayern beating Barcelona 8-2, Man City going out 3-1 to the 7th best team in Liga, and Man United exiting the Europa League to Sevilla last night. It's like a football show after a World Cup weekend, basically.
It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. You know, who else but Lennon, Murph, to...
Vladimir Ilyich or John?
Which Vladimir Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov? Which quote am I going for? Which Lenin quote am I going for? Of course.
Oh, there are decades when nothing happens, and there are weeks when decades happen.
What an amazing weekend for Raul Sanlehi to be shown the door at Arsenal as they scratch their heads and ponder the details of the 4 billion euro deal taking Nicolas Pepe from Lille to Arsenal last summer. What an amazing week, because any other time we'd just be talking about Raul Sanlehi for the next hour, but we're basically not going to do that. I mean, hopefully we'll remember to come back to him at some point.
I to be honest, I doubt it, Ken.
But look, you know, just game after game from Friday, Saturday and Sunday. I mean, this massive operatic tragedy of Friday night. You know, you've got everything. You've got like dying swans. You've got like hysterical people, faces daubed with clown makeup, crying. You know, you've got like people falling backwards into tubas. It's just like, what, you know, everyone screaming, crying, you know, absolute Götterdämmerung disaster. Then on Saturday, you've got this like offbeat Curb Your Enthusiasm farce of Manchester City. Like, what? Pep Guardiola comes out and just engages in an absolute clown show, like a parody of himself, taking the piss out of himself, and losing in the most Pep way yet. And then last night it was almost like a sort of a sense of a fresh beginning. You know, like we've had the tragedy, we've had the farce, and now it's kind of, we're back out on the road again. With a young, fresh team that has got a lot of experience this season. A lot of experience, particularly losing semi-finals. More experience of losing semi-finals than anyone's ever had before in a single season. I think it was Richard Jolly with that statistic again. No one's done this before.
Yeah.
You've never seen the like of this before. No one has ever lost the League Cup, FA Cup and European semi-final in one season before until now. So, but you know, at the same time, it didn't have quite the, it didn't have the sort of jeopardy, let's say, of the other two matches. You know, because what was really at stake?
Yeah, I mean,
the Europa League, like they won it a couple of years ago. You know, who cares? I mean, Sevilla have all the Europa League records. You know, they're further ahead in Europa League records than ever before. Record, sixth final. They've scored more goals than anyone, I think, in the competition. They've got all the Europa League records, which are like, it's like having all the under 21 records of your national team. It's like, you know, I am I've got the most under 21 caps and goals. And you're like, where did it all go wrong for you? So, you know, Man United at least get to go on holidays now. And, of course, try again. And all of this experience that they have is going to stand to them, I assume, in the next semi-final they make it to.
The football continues with these two scarcely believable combinations in the Champions League semi-finals. On Tuesday and Wednesday, the Europa League final is Friday. The Champions League final itself is on Saturday. What I'm trying to tell you is we'll be going stone daft on the football this week. So why not join us here on the World Service for daily shows costing you just €5 a month plus VAT. We'd love to have you along. We'll be hearing from Raphael Honigstein and Miguel Delaney just a little later on. But it's now time for you to report on some sport there, please, Ken.
So, what do you think, Murph? Is Messi the problem? I mean, if I'm putting you in the spot and saying, is Lionel Messi the problem in Barcelona?
To be honest, there's no way that I could ever stand over anyone saying that Lionel Messi is a problem in a football.
A problem? I mean, I said the problem, which was obviously an extreme way of stating questions. And the correct answer to my question is obviously no. The problem? Yeah. No, he can't possibly be. But a problem? Ooh. Mm. Well, that's, I don't know, that's a bit more of a complicated question.
No, he's just too good at football to jettison. You know, I mean, like, that's a pretty simplistic argument if you're the, you know, one of the decision makers at Barcelona. But I mean, surely the fact that he's really, really, really fucking good at football has to come into
Tim.
Yeah.
No, I agree. I mean, and if he were the I think one good way to answer this question is, because there is now a serious debate over whether you should, you know, whether they need to move on from Messi, because, you know, he does soak up so much of the budget and he does impose certain limitations on the team. That is, the limitation being, without the ball, you've got 10 men. You know, he's not really going to, I mean, 10 men plus, you know, one player who can become active, you know, because he is moving around.
We've won on standby.
And he does arguably, you know, take up good positions, and he is someone they're going to have to be aware of on the counter. But, you know, he's not going to try and actually get the ball back in any active way. Okay, fair enough. But would Lionel Messi have been a problem in the Bayern Munich team on Friday night? The answer is, I don't think so. I think he would have probably improved the Bayern Munich team. You know, but Bayern Munich have the structure around him to compensate for the things that he doesn't do. The same way that Barcelona used to have, and the way that they no longer have. I mean, there was the seventh goal. I mean, the drama of Coutinho coming on and scoring two goals and setting up a goal in like 10 minutes as the most expensive player in Barcelona's history is just like...
Yeah, like, I'll tell you one thing, actually, just kind of dawning me as you're talking about kind of the Barcelona game, but we'll also talk about, obviously, the City game as well, which is really weird in that they seem like the most dramatic things imaginable, but it's also, we're repeating stuff that was said, you know what I mean? It's just like, it's just been distilled over the course of one kind of 24-hour period. But like, last year, we were watching videos of Lionel Messi at Anfield just not doing anything for 40 minutes. You know what I mean? Like, refusing to track back. Like, we'll be doing the same when we end up talking about Pep as well. Like, that's what's kind of weird about it, because, like, the weekend, it did feel like theatre. It did feel like operatic levels of drama and all the rest, as you said. But at the same time, you know, we've kind of seen this play out before as well.
Yeah, well, I suppose the old stories are the best. I mean, it's true. But we haven't seen Barcelona lose 8-2 before.
Yeah.
This is like,
well, not in one over the course of one game, I suppose. Yeah,
it's true. 7-0, you know, 7-0 against Bayern in 2013 over two games. And, you know, you could say there were some of the same issues, some of the same problems at that point. But in this case, you know, the seventh goal was the Coutinho goal, the Coutinho first goal. And if you remember what happened, Barcelona tried to play the ball out, and Messi kind of comes back into his own half, gets the ball, turns around. And if you stop it there, there are five Bayern players closer to him than the nearest Barcelona player. And you just think, would Bayern have allowed this to happen to him if he was their teammate? Would Bayern have abandoned him in the same way? I mean, clearly not. Bayern seemed to be paying much closer attention to him than any of his teammates, judging by the way they're all converging on him. And his teammates are standing watching this happen. You know, their QB is getting sacked here by five players simultaneously. This is just... So surely someone's gonna at least try to get involved here, but no. He is kind of turning, and he's going to play the pass to De Jong, I think, who's the closest, although not as close as five players. And one of the Bayern players he hadn't seen, Lewandowski, is behind him and nicks the ball away from him. And then he doesn't run. And Bayern all run through, and Coutinho, who was one of the five players around him, arrives in the box to score the goal. And you could say, well, is this because Messi doesn't run anymore, or is it because he's really on his own out there? And I think the problem is, okay, he doesn't run, and you could get away with that if it was just him doing it, but unfortunately, it's half the team. It's actually half the team. Now, did you see Thomas Müller after the game? I mean, obviously, he had a great night.
Yeah, he did have a very good night. He seemed to be enjoying himself immensely.
I mean, he did tell that joke in the... We might as well play it. Yeah.
But we in Bayern, we have Robert Lewandowski. You know, Robert Lewandowski.
I mean, that's just so good. Like, you can obviously hear the delivery and the context, because that is to an audience. Like that reaction is what the audience reaction was. But the face as he does it just makes it 10 times funnier. He reminds me of like a Lloyd Bridges character or something. There's something Lloyd Bridges-y about him, the way he kind of comes back. He's like undeterred. He's like, I'll have another go at that. They obviously didn't hear that one. Robert Lewandowski? Everyone's like, oh God, are you going to keep going? I personally, if I'd been there, I definitely would have laughed at that.
Yeah, like, see, this is the thing. We have talked on the show before about, you know, journalists at press conferences laughing, you know, uproariously at the merest suggestion of a joke.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, like, that's the alternative, you know?
Yeah.
Like, a really top-class athlete being made to look like a complete idiot.
Well, you know, I thought...
I mean, he didn't... I don't think he was that bothered. He wasn't.
No, he wasn't. So. He's like, well, you know, obviously, you know, they're not into that kind of material.
Too edgy for you guys?
The biggest joke that Müller's been involved in this year is the joke he's made of Yogi Löw, the German national team manager, who, remember, at the beginning of the season or last summer or whatever, like a million years ago, announced that he and Jerome Boateng and Mats Hummels would no longer be invited to the German national team anymore. And they were all very hurt by this. And since then, they've all had, well, pretty good seasons. I mean, you know, Boateng and Müller, is a good chance they're going to win the Champions League. They've still got two matches to go, of course. But, you know, Müller's been playing really well. I think he's set an assist record this season. Obviously scored again a couple of goals. Again, he's there in the German team, destroys, 7-1 and 8-2. The big matches he's been involved in, has scored twice in. Franz Beckenbauer saying, Müller, see if you can... I know you don't speak German, Kieran, but see if you can figure out...
Well, excuse me, I did 3 years of it.
So, oh, okay, so you do. Continue. Well, I'd say you'd be able to figure out what...
I definitely do. What's Franz
Beckenbauer trying to say here? He says, Müller ist jetzt der absolute leader.
Müller is still an absolute leader.
Is now the absolute leader.
Shit.
And he praises Müller's Persönlichkeit. Yes! Müller's Persönlichkeit could really help the national team. But Müller, anyway, was in his but seriously section of his post-match interviews, was saying, you know, team spirit is often this thing, you know, when everyone goes for a drink at night and, like, has a great time, and it's like, oh, we've got such great team spirit. But no, That's not what team spirit is about. What it's really about is everybody's doing the things that we need. Out in the field, everybody's doing it. And everyone has to suffer. This is the point. Everyone has to suffer. Like, everyone has to physically suffer. Because why? Because they're chasing around all the time, trying to close down all the spaces and choke Barcelona and, you know, break up their team. This is all the things that Barcelona weren't doing, more or less. Mm. I mean, there's a quote from Kimmich. Honestly, it was a brutal game. You could see we wanted to win this match at all costs. We played with great determination and were very brave. After conceding their fifth goal, Barcelona stopped believing. After the fifth goal. And actually, that's true. I thought the same watching it. Remember I thought that Barcelona had probably stopped believing after the fourth goal. In fact, in the first 4-1 and what, 30 minutes?
Insane conversation, yeah.
You know, and you're like, yeah. Okay... We know who's going to win this match now. 4-1 with an hour to go. The question is here, can Bayern get double figures, really, rather than can Barcelona come back and win this? And, you know, there was a photo, I don't know if you saw, of... And I think just after the 4-1, was that when Ter Stegen threw the ball straight to Lewandowski? Or, you know, there was this insane moment where, like, he just passed it straight to somebody.
Yeah, yeah.
Lewandowski nearly scored. I can't remember if that was 3-1 or 4-1. But there was that photo, I don't know if you saw, of Messi in the dressing room and Ter Stegen at the door. Messi's just slumped.
Yeah, I didn't know if that was at halftime or at
full time. It was halftime. That was halftime. So I don't think there was much belief there. But when they scored the 4-2, there was still enough time. It was 33 minutes. It's like, can they score two goals? It's possible that could happen. You know what I mean? You couldn't help but at least have a little flurry of, oh, lads, you know, we're still in this. You know, this could be, it could all be about to turn around for us now. And then a couple of minutes later, Alphonso Davies just absolutely kills off the last faint hope. And it's a move which makes you remember. I don't know if you saw Alphonso Davies before this game. He was talking about...
I saw him against... Oh, sorry, go on, yeah.
His dad was saying... He was saying, oh, you know, my dad called me up and my dad was like, hey, so, Alphonso, I guess you're playing against your favorite player. And they were having a laugh over the fact that, like, he was now playing against his hero, who he'd sort of idolized growing up or whatever, and now he's going to get to play against Messi, blah, blah, blah. But here he was. He's up against Semedo. Oh, you know, it wasn't a good night for Semedo. It wasn't a good night for a lot of Barcelona players, but particularly Semedo. Destroys him, runs down the left, and into the box and keeps holding on to the ball until the very last second. The composure of this guy to delay the pass for so long with players, like, he's running quickly and there's players all around him and he's got no space. He's right there by the end line and still he's able to hold the pass until the very last possible second he can play it to totally take the goalkeeper out of the game and give Kimmich a tap in. Was incredible, just the composure of this guy to do that. Mm. And it was like, this is why the game now is belonging to all the players who grew up watching Messi, rather than, you know, Messi didn't have this advantage. You know what I mean? He didn't. You know, we were talking about Ronnie O'Sullivan last week, and Ronnie O'Sullivan's hilarious quote about how shit snooker was now, and he's like, all the snooker players are shit now. Nobody, you know, yeah, there hasn't been any good players in ages, or whatever. And which is kind of funny, just that somebody would be rude enough to say that. But, you know, it's not saying much for the game of snooker, you know, in the sense that, oh, like, it's a dying game. But, like, of course it is.
Cause someone should have stuck a fork in me 10 years ago, but no one has, so here I am.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with snooker is it's really boring, you know. It's a basic problem with it. Like, but, you know, in the 70s, it sort of had a chance, right? If you were growing up in the 70s, snooker seemed quite interesting. You know, if you compare it to just the experience of walking around in the street, or, you know, what was on TV then, or lots of sort of aspects, even just the colors, even just the nice colors, the green, the brightly colored balls, you know, compared to the sort of drab.
How dull do you think life was in the
90s? Well, look, I actually come from the 70s, so, you know, I speak of my own decade, in a sense. But, okay, the point about it is, like, snooker is like a game of extreme technical skill, you know, at the highest level. And in order to get that good at something so boring, like the time that you have to put in, and actually the boredom of what it is that you're doing, I just don't know how anyone now could ever get to Ronnie O'Sullivan's level again. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, now you basically,
there are too many distractions to,
you've got a phone,
snooker hole.
You know, you've got a phone, you know, you've got like, maybe you've got a PlayStation, you know, maybe you've got like Fortnite or whatever. How is it possible for snooker to survive in the age of Fortnite? It's just like an earlier evolutionary stage of entertainment. I mean, obviously there'll still be some people who do it. There's still this sport, you know, it's worth getting good at it. You might be able to win, I don't know, 40 grand or something. But like, you're never going to spend your whole youth doing it in the way that Ronnie O'Sullivan clearly did. The way that like the really good snooker players used to do. It just can't compete.
The widely debunked 10,000 hours theory. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it probably takes much more than that. But you know, I do think like, I know that the 10,000 hours theory has been debunked. I mean, and the thing that's fake about the 10,000 hours theory is the notion that like, it's like this general law. Like if anyone who does this is going to get there, and that, you know, the fact is that talent does exist. Some people get there a lot more quickly. Some people will do 10,000 hours and not get there. You know what I mean? It's not like this. Do your practice and you get there. There's a lot more to it. You know, this is the point.
Yes.
But you do need to practice. And I did wonder with that, like, how are all of these sort of tech? I mean, I think because we raised this point before in relation to tennis, which is also like a bit boring, you know.
It's not as boring though.
No, it's
when
not.
You're
it's
playing
not
tennis,
as boring because
you
get to run around and you get to break a sweat, you know, and it's a bit like, it feels a bit healthier and you're outdoors and obviously it's a bit social, isn't it? I suppose snooker is a bit social as well, but like you know, it's still not great though. It's still not great. And I did wonder if it was going to have kind of the same problem. Like, you know, here we have a very dull mechanical skill, which requires vast quantities of time to get good at, and really who has the time anymore? And surely at some level, this starts to apply to football as well. But I think, you know, when you see Alphonso Davies, you're reminded, okay, actually one difference is that there's so much of football which isn't about your individual ability on the ball, but also about how you relate to the other 21 players on the field. You can learn so much about it by watching. You know what I mean? Like the players who have grown up watching Lionel Messi play football are better players as a result. Like they have been able to absorb things from watching him that he had to work out for himself, or had to wait till Barcelona to wait till he got to Barcelona for someone to sort of instruct him in this, you know, a coach at like one of the top clubs in the world.
Do you think his influence is that huge?
Of course, because he's the one player everyone's been watching. Everyone in the world who's interested in, well, not the one player, because there's like a couple of other players, but you know him.
Well, I think maybe the point might be correct, but it might be more complicated than just the fact that it's Messi. There's also the fact that you can see literally everything that Messi does now in a way that even like 25 years ago, like, you couldn't see every game that Zinedine Zidane played throughout his career. Like, you can literally watch every single second of Leo Messi's entire career, you know, over the course of the last 15 years, in a way that you couldn't with any other player before now. Like, that's certainly a massive point, I would say.
Yeah, well. Zlatan, I think, has a thing in his autobiography where he talks about how he had been able to collect like a few video clips of like Ronaldo doing dribbles and stuff, which he would like watch on his enormous gray Bakelite computer. And try to learn each of the individual components of the moves, and then go and do himself. So obviously, it took him, like, he had to be almost like a sort of a hacker to be able to assemble like this this puny archive of footage. Whereas now, like, you're everyone is sort of saturated in these sorts of images, and you can see, you know, like what Davis did was just like this preternatural composure, which honestly would have been just so exceptional 15 years ago, but is now kind of normal in a way. Like someone like Jadon Sancho, you can see has the same type of quality, where like it's like they've been in all these situations before. You know, it's like they've they're not sort of surprised. I don't know. It's difficult for me to explain. I'm probably talking nonsense. I should probably get back to talking actually about the game here. Because, okay, we know what happened in the game. It was a total disaster. What is going to happen now? There's rival stories, you know, because obviously this is a situation that demands immediate narrative. And in one of the rival stories, Lionel Messi has already told Barcelona, that's it, I'm out. It's over. It's over. Sell me. I'm not coming back. I'll never play for you again. And in the other narrative, Josep Bartomeu, the Barcelona president, the somewhat under fire Barcelona, somewhat beleaguered, has...
I would say.
he has said, all right, that's it. No more nonsense. I've seen this go on long enough, and now it's time for me to roll up my sleeves and get this sorted. Right? He's going to step in and sort it out. And in this narrative, Messi's staying, but Suarez is leaving along with a bunch of other players, and Ronald Koeman is the guy, it says here. Ronald Koeman is the guy who's going to come in and sort all this out. And it wouldn't be the first time that Ronald Koeman had been offered this job. He's turned it down before. He's still the Dutch national team manager. And I'm not sure if he's crazy enough to take the Barcelona job right now. But the question is, okay, what is going to happen? Like, you know, is this Messi's going to... I don't find the Messi leaving story... Let's wait and see what happens. But I don't find it credible at the moment. There's a couple of reasons for it. One is that I just can't see how he can leave and that be his last game and this be his last 2 months as a Barcelona player.
I saw you writing about even the idea of like the empty crowds, like the idea that he can't get a goodbye in the new camp. Like, I don't see that as a factor at all. You know what I mean? Like, if he thinks he should go, then he should go. The idea of sticking around to wait for a goodbye, which, by the way, might not come in the next 12 months. Like, there's no guarantee there'll be 85,000 people in the new camp at any stage in 2021 or 2022. So, I mean, I think you got to make the decision on its merits, not, you know, not hang around because I feel like I owe it to this crowd that I may not meet in the next 18 months.
I don't know. I think that would be crazy. I think only someone with no sense of narrative. Unfortunately, maybe Lionel Messi is one of those folks. You know, he does express himself through football, not notably through narrative at any point. But really, here's the other reason why I'm a bit skeptical about this. How much is it going to cost to actually sign him? A lot, right? I mean, Barcelona are not going to let him go cheap, especially if he's saying, "Oh, I'm leaving," and they don't want him to go just yet. Although, you know, maybe they're like, "Oh no, you know, really, must you leave?" As they like, you know, prepare the exit. But there's also his salary, which is what, in the region of 60-70 million euros. I mean, who's going to pay that? Here's the question: are you going to pay this type of money? Salary plus, maybe he'll take a cut in the salary. Maybe he's that desperate to get out of there. But are you going to pay this type of money and risk signing Argentina Messi? Like, are you risking signing a guy who turns up ashen-faced, heartbroken, and homesick? You know, and just pining for, you know, like, remember, this is a guy who quit playing for Argentina I don't know how many times. He has a habit of doing this. He's like, oh, I'll never play for this again. And then... like a couple of months later, it's like, oh, look, I'm coming back. I'm sorry about that. You know, I took the defeat hard, but now I'm back. And I think that's happened about 4 times, right? I mean, he's quit Argentina like on several different occasions.
Yeah, a number of times. Yes,
so,
certainly.
You know, I mean, he's a homebody. You know what I mean? What's he going to go to Inter? Like, play for Antonio Conte? Are you joking? Like, are you joking? Where's he going to go? Play for Pep again at Man City?
I don't think there's any chance.
Well, you never know. As I sort of spat the word Pep, I suddenly thought, well, you never know. Like, I mean, City could afford him. It depends on how much he hates Barcelona's directors now. I think he really does hate them. But I just feel as though this club is such a big part of his life. This is the greatest career in the history of that club. Like, they can't. They can just let him go in these circumstances. They owe him the big, you know.
Yeah. Like, I think that, like, one of the key things when discussing, you know, the possibility of Messi leaving is that, you know, the idea, like, this would be a much thornier problem if his mates that, you know, are hanging around were still like the second, third, fourth, fifth best players in the club. They're like, they might be, but that's only because everyone else is so cowed into submission by this group of players that they're all playing terribly as well. Yeah. Like, you know, there's like a very good football reason to get rid of all of his mates. If that wasn't there, then I would look on this Messi issue as you know, a much more complicated problem than it is. I mean, just get rid of those guys. Have Messi maybe a bit pissed off, but also Messi at this stage surely realizes.
Look, you've got to accept, like, that, like, you know, it's sad. You and Luis, it's sad, but you know, I mean, he can still live next door to you. He just has to play for Espanyol now.
Where could he commute to? I mean, is Valencia
Girona,
3 hours away?
Sure, yeah. Could do Girona, you know, being a bit of a schlep. I saw there's a story, you know, Ajax want him back. I'm just imagining him moving back to Amsterdam, you know, a winter in Amsterdam. A winter going. Have you ever been to Amsterdam in the winter? Oh, it's cold. but look, I do wonder what direction Barcelona are going to take, you know, longer term. And I think I have a feeling that it might be kind of a bit more of a Catalan turn in the next little while.
But doesn't he already have a job, a very well paid job in the Middle East?
Are you talking about Pep?
I'm talking about Xavi.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, I know he does, but no, I mean, there's no doubt that he would be interested, although not for the doomed Bartomeu, who nobody wants to work for. Nobody wants to be associated with this guy. I mean, there's a question there over when is he going to realize it's checkmate for him? You know, even Florentino Perez realized that there came a point when he, as Real Madrid president, when he said, oh, I've got to go. I've lost credibility. I, Florentino Perez, I'm a busted flush. And he resigned in 2006. You know, he quit. And he obviously came back. I don't think Bartomeu would ever be coming back. But sometimes you got to go, you know? Mm. But one way or the other, you imagine that the successor would be another Catalan. I was speaking to Aidan Regan, you know, who we've had on the Politics podcast a couple of times. And he, you know, just about the game, and he was like, oh, this is crazy. And then we were talking about, he sent me on this paper about the reasons why Barcelona has fallen behind Madrid in all kinds of economic terms. Barcelona used to be the economic powerhouse and kind of the most dynamic city in Spain. But that's not the case anymore. It's been overtaken in all kinds of, ways by Madrid. And basically every economic indicator, you know, GDP per capita and like total size of economy and population size and blah, blah, blah. And this paper by a couple of guys at the London School of Economics was about this. Why has this happened? And obviously the Catalan nationalist account of this is, well, of course, it's because the government in Madrid is a stitch up. They just tax us and then give the money to themselves, and you know, we need to get out. But according to this paper anyway, they're saying, no, we think that the reason this has happened is because the emphasis on Catalan identity, Catalan language, Catalan this, Catalan that, has actually had the effect of, over time, making Barcelona once the most open and outward-looking of the Spanish cities, because it was defining itself against Franco, against the center, against the dictatorship, which was, you know, insular, autarkic, you know, all of these types of, you know, this is kind of a depressing, backward, fascist dictatorship. Right, and Barcelona obviously was opposed to this from the very beginning, was kind of the opposite of that, but also was defining itself as, like, you know, we know that there's a world outside Spain, you know, we're kind of oriented towards the rest of Europe, we want to be open, you know. And you could see that in the 70s, you know, when Barcelona was the football club that was like saying, come Johan Cruyff and Runes Mikkels, bring your great ideas, you know, revolutionize us. Let's get up to speed with this. Let's start playing Dutch football here in Barcelona. You know what I mean? Like, they're kind of like, we'll adopt your sort of international ideas. But that over time, and they reckon that, you know, in the paper, again, I'm just relating what was in this paper, up to about the 92 Olympics, which obviously were in Barcelona, this kind of worked to Barcelona's advantage. But since then has actually begun to sort of go the other direction, has begun to become a bit of a barrier to outsiders, that there's, you know, a glass ceiling in Barcelona, that you need to be a Catalan to be anyone in Barcelona. You need to be not only a Catalan, you need to be very self-consciously Catalan.
Mm.
You need to, you know, they're talking about the assortative mating. You know, the fact that in Catalonia, there is a correlation between the degree to which someone says, I am Catalan, or I'm not Spanish, I'm Catalan, and their social class. How, you know, the richer you are, the more Catalan you are likely to say you are. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So over time, the sort of ruling elite has become like ultra-Catalan, and people who aren't ultra-Catalan, which is to say still actually quite a lot of people in Barcelona, not to mention all of the foreigners who come there from all over Europe and the world, they're kind of excluded, you know, in that sort of sense. Well, you know, you're not sort of the real people. We know who the real people in this city are.
Right. Okay.
So this was kind of an interesting an interesting account, and it just sort of struck me that this reminds me a little bit of the team, you know, in the sense of this is a club where when you arrive there, you know, they're always saying these kind of patronizing things about brilliant new players who arrive. Oh, they need to learn to play, you know, football.
The Barcelona way, yes.
This guy, you know, thinks he's a good player, but he's never actually played football before, you know, and instead in the team, you've got this sort of group of like guys who've been there for a long time. Messi's not actually Catalan, but he kind of, you know, he's honorary.
I'm glad that the bar is lowered so that Lionel Messi can become a Catalan. No one else, obviously, but Lionel Messi has done enough service to Catalonia so that we can grudgingly refer to him as Catalan. Yeah, yeah.
You know, although at the same time, you know. so you know, and this, I think maybe it sort of illustrates one of the reasons why it's been difficult for outsiders to break in. Outsiders, by which I mean new players. None of the new signings have stuck for like 6 years. I thought it was an interesting parallel. But I think now, like, this is the time, this is the moment, as Barcelona survey the rest of Europe, and Real Madrid have won the league, even though their team is no good, they've still managed to win the league. Bayern have just smashed them 8-2. They look much better than them. You know, last season, Liverpool beat them 4-0, and they still look stronger than them. And the Premier League in general is always creating teams with the power to sort of challenge Barcelona. And then you've got Paris, who obviously took Neymar off them. And there they are in the semi-finals of the Champions League with all their Qatar money. And then you've got Red Bull. You've got Red Bull in the semi-finals of the Champions League. They're attached to Leipzig. The city of Leipzig, but it's a Red Bull team, like in Formula One. The Red Bull team is now in with the Paris.
It stands Paris for Razzin Bull, Ken. Jesus. Yeah.
The Red Bull team is in the semifinals along with Bayern Munich, PSG and Lyon. Right? It's just like Formula One. Now this is a changing football landscape. Barcelona are not there anymore, and they're slipping relative to all of these new and in some cases, horrible entities. You know, Qatar, Red Bull. Like, what? These guys shouldn't even be allowed in the game. You know? I think there's never been a better moment for Barcelona to remember that football is about more than that. Football is about more than just winning. It's about more than money. You know? It's not all about trophies, glory, power. Football is also about identity. It's about community. Mm. It's about regional pride.
I'm a little concerned about some of the words you're using here, but anyway.
Why?
Just identity and community pride. I mean, what exactly are you envisaging here?
Not necessarily an actual like blood and soil type of return.
I just like, felt like you needed to confirm that for us.
I'm just talking about some, you know, good Catalan names and the, you know, youth players coming through. You know, we just need to refresh the team with some. With, you know, Catalonia's a bloody fine part of Europe, Murph. It's a bloody fine part of Europe, and you got to wonder if it's really getting enough of a look in. I mean, this has happened before at Barcelona, when Louis van Gaal was the manager 20 years ago, and he tried to fill, and he, in fact, had filled the team largely with Dutch players. There was, you know, if you think back, Kluivert, Overmars,
Cocu,
the two De Boers, Reiziger, Ruud Hesp, the goalkeeper, God, I'm probably
that'll do for
out.
A start.
Yeah, there was like a lot of Dutch players, and people were like, "Oh, why have we got all these Dutch players? What about these Catalan players? You know, they should be given a go." And I remember, I actually the line sticks in my head. It's Simon Cooper article from way back saying, "Well, the reason is that like these seasoned Dutch internationals are better than young Catalans." But of course, one of the young Catalans in question was like Xavi. You know what I mean, it turned out that actually dumping these guys, putting these guys in the team, had a salutary effect. There might be a bit of that coming around again. Time is a closed circle. I can already see these. Sid Lowe had a tweet there. Some Barca directors have told Bartomeu. No, he says Carousel reporting. Some Barca directors have told Bartomeu he shouldn't go through with his idea to appoint his chosen new coach. That's Bartomeu's chosen new coach. We can't sign Pochettino, they say, because of fan reaction to his Espanyol past and previous comments. Well, there you go. You know, Pochettino is impure. He doesn't really get what Catalonia is all about. Espanyol
indeed. Roots. Come on, lads.
Espanyol, indeed. And another one here from Lucas Omar Tapia. Here's something. Here is a did you know? He writes. I think he means here's an interesting fact. Stoichkov, Christo, spoke to Bartomeu about Davis Alfonso months before Bayern came on board. His response was, "He's Canadian. No thanks." So, yeah, maybe. I don't know if it's really the same thing. There haven't been any great players from Canada apart from Owen Hargreaves. He looks a bit like Daniel Farke now, I see. they look like Daniel Farke. We have to get to United. Let's quickly do City. Why does Pep not trust skillful players? what does Pep have against creative midfielders? Why does he do this? Why does he leave out Silva, Mahrez, Foden? Come on.
Yeah. I do understand, you know, that you have to change your team to sometimes to accommodate who you're playing. But at the same time, like, it bears repeating. It's been said many, many times. But like, seventh in Ligue 1, like a league that is derided, a farmers' league, league.
Well, you said, did you see Mbappe tweeting that?
I sure did.
I think it's good the way we all just live in exactly the same culture now. It doesn't matter where, what country, just the same, like 100 references everybody lives in. But I saw Jonathan Wilson making the point that he was tracing it back to the 2014 Real Madrid-Bayern match when Pep was the Bayern manager. And if you remember, they lost 1-0 away to Madrid, having, you know, 97% of possession or whatever. And Real Madrid still managed to win 1-0. And then the Bayern players got to him, you see. The Bayern players were like, "Oh, Pep, you know, we have Persönlichkeit, you know, we can absolutely score many Toren against these guys if you just let us off the leash. We're like a pack of wild dogs, let us off the leash." And Pep was like, "Go on then, lads." And so he did, and he let the dogs off the leash. They all ran forward. Real Madrid kicked the ball behind them and ran in behind and scored 4 goals. 4-0. And so Pep loses 4-0 to Madrid. Now, of course, he's got used to these bitter defeats over time, but at the time, he'd never had anything like that. You know, I think it was his biggest ever defeat in his career at that time. 4-0. 5-0 on aggregate, especially to Real Madrid, you know, who he absolutely despises. And he just decided, never again. I'm just never, ever, ever going to do it again. Now, what was the never again point that he makes that's in that Marty Perrineau book is, "Never again will I allow my judgment to be clouded by the input of players."
Which is fine, but I mean, you should probably allow your judgment to be clouded by, you know, defeat after defeat after defeat after defeat in the Champions League quarterfinal stage.
Yeah. Well, you know, it seems as though it was almost broader, like, "Never again will I allow a gung-ho attacking approach in a big game." You know what I mean? That there's a bit of that, because, you know, we've seen, well, no, because in fact that can't be true, because he did try it the following season, Bayern against Barcelona, at least for like a bit of the first leg. They, you know, he tried to really go for Barcelona and gave away a string of chances, and then was like, oh, you know, Jesus Christ, I'm about to die here on the sideline watching this. Get back, defend the goal, you know. But like, so this is ever since then he's been like, no, control is the thing. You know, we can't be like allowing too much attack. Anyway, one way or the other, he keeps coming out with these weird teams, as he did against Liverpool. When, you know, Gundogan is always involved. Gundogan's kind of become a bit of a lightning rod among the City. Oh, I'm not Gundogan again. But then last night, or not last night, Saturday night. Again, it's just like, what are you doing? At some point, it's got to be like, can we not just play what we usually do? And then if we lose, at least like, at least the argument will be different. It won't be, oh, Pep's done a weird one on it again. Mm. Now, Pep, the problem, of course, one reason why this is a pretty toxic situation at Man City is that Pep, obviously, it's that everyone can sort of point the finger at everyone else. Like, it's like Guardiola's weird. Did you see De Bruyne's interview after the game?
Yeah.
Had a distinctly exasperated tone, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of thought, like, even his tone of voice and his face meant that he was going to say something. You know, so I was kind of watching it for, like, the bombshell quote where, like, we should have just picked our own team and, you know, we're good enough to beat these guys and that's it. He didn't actually say it, but...
He said we started slow first half. We didn't have any options or something like that. That was what he said. And I thought that what that meant was the manager picked the wrong team. And then, you know, we sort of got things going. But then, and then he made the point about Sterling. And this is the problem. You know, when any sort of analysis that says Pep, again, he made a mess of it.
Hmm.
Pep is saying, sorry, guys, but did you actually see what happened in the game, by the way? Because there was a moment there when, you know, it had somewhat opened up for us. You know, for a moment the clouds parted and I could see a clear blue sky. And then it was like suddenly everything went black. Now, I'm just trying to remember what exactly it was that happened in that moment. Oh, yeah. Raheem Sterling produced a career-defining miss. At the moment of truth, Raheem Sterling produced the moment that guarantees that for the next 10 or 15 years around the planet, wherever balls are blazed over open goals from point blank range, the name of Sterling will resound. That's literally what it is. You know what I mean? It's like, how can you have done that? How can you, like, it's almost defies belief. The miss, because you see, there was the Micah Richards and Carragher. I don't know if you saw their reaction clip, but like Richards is cheering from the moment he sees the ball, from the moment he sees Gabriel Jesus' cross, he can see it's going to Sterling. This is a goal.
Mm.
Like it's so obvious, and he's cheering, and then that the cheer turns into, oh my God, and then there was this argument. Lineker, I think, was saying, well, the problem is there, he's hit it too well.
Yeah. Well, I was going to boil it down to that because I was going to mention, actually, Lineker, because I thought it was kind of interesting. He was like, don't try and kick it. Just let it hit you, you know? But I mean, like, the idea that you're sitting there kind of trying to analyze, you know, what possibly could have gone wrong mechanically with this. It's like, lads, like, he's 2 yards out. I mean, there's no right or wrong way to finish from 2 yards out with the keeper... You know, when the ball is past the keeper, you know, it's literally just like, we should be sitting here talking about what mechanically went kaput in his like neural synapses that allowed him to miss this goal, you know?
It's amazing. And you know, and particularly with a manager like Guardiola, who you recall told Sterling, I can't forgive mistakes like that.
Yeah,
you can't forgive mistakes like that. This is against Burnley, and he subbed him off against Burnley. And Sam Lee, so the City correspondent for The Guardian, had made the point after Lineker said, well, the thing is, he's, you know, you don't want to hit that too hard. You need to just steer that one. Just make sure it doesn't go up. And because, you know, that's what the pace on the ball does the rest, whatever. He said, it's interesting because it's the exact opposite of what the coaching staff at City told him after he missed that sitter against Burnley. They said... Just fucking hit it. What are you doing? Just twat it into the net. That apparently was their advice. But if you look at them, they're slightly different. The Burnley one, the way that he misses that it's a more difficult chance, much more difficult. The ball, again, it comes over from the right. It's a similar type of situation. It comes over from the right. He sticks his foot out and it sort of squiffs off his foot, let's say, and goes wide of the far post. You know, so he doesn't knock it over, but he doesn't get enough force on it, I guess, it's an opposite thing. It's like he's more stretching for this one. Whereas the one against Leon, he just has to side foot that ball. Like, it's just, he's fully in control. He's not off balance. He's not stretching. You know, it's just there.
Yeah.
What Lineker is saying, I suppose, just block the path of the ball directed goalwards. Whereas in the other one, he kind of actually had to try to do more than he did. So that explains, I guess, the difference in advice. But it just goes to show there's no hard and fast rule. I mean, the thing is that Raheem Sterling actually knows what he needs to do in either case. He just he just didn't manage to produce the finish. And it's just, it's a real, like, no one will ever forget it. You know what I mean? Because it's not like the Burnley miss. Pep's managed to make that one famous enough. You know, no one would remember it if it wasn't for Pep going on and on about it the whole time and it being in that documentary and so on. Everyone would have forgotten that because it's a game. Like, who cares? Like, did they won the game? Did they win the game? Maybe they drew it, but like, it's a Premier League game. You know, like, Man City.
There's 38 of them every year.
This is a Champions League quarterfinal. Everyone is watching this. All of Sterling's peers. All players, everyone saw that. And, you know, like, and the way that Pep talks about it, I don't agree with his attitude of, you can't forgive a mistake like that. Because I think it's sort of stupid. Everyone makes these mistakes from time to time, you know. But, you know, Sterling knows that that's what he thinks.
Yeah.
he can't sort of say, you know, that time I said that about that those mistakes and being unforgivable. I didn't actually mean that.
Yeah.
What I meant was they are forgivable. I still, Raheem, wish you'd scored it.
But I don't blame you. I'm not going to wake up with your face implanted on my brain every morning for the next 6 months.
But you saw the United game. Imagine if Bruno Fernandes is that pissed off with Lindelof over that goal that somebody scored. Imagine what the City players think about the Sterling miss. You know what I mean? Because obviously Leon then goes straight up the other end and score. Now, they don't even have the opportunity to get really angry about the refereeing that didn't somehow spot that Dembele had tripped Laporte. Now, this was for the second goal, which turned out to be the winning goal. But they can't even, they don't have the opportunity to get annoyed about that. That was an interesting goal as well, though, because Laporte, it was a mistake by him. Even though he was tripped in the sense of, it's that type of trip you sometimes see like an ankle tap type trip.
Yeah.
I don't think it was deliberate, but it did happen. So it's a foul, right? I mean, because you've knocked the player down with contact, which isn't related to the ball. That's a foul. But look, it's also a mistake by Laporte, like a bad mistake. He comes out of defense as he's supposed to do, plays a risky pass into the middle, which gets cut out. Now he's like, oh no, miles out of position. They've got an Arrigo position, they counterattack. And he comes back. And what he tries to do is run across the run of Dembele to slow him up. And it's in making that little move to the side, that's when he gets tripped. He kind of brings it on himself, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's still a foul, though. So what am I talking about? But again, you don't get the chance to be annoyed when you lose 3-1. You know, the mood in the City camp, Bernardo Silva decides to take on internet Liverpool fans.
Oh my God. That was a bad idea. Such a bad idea.
Just don't get involved there. That's not one that you can win. You know,
if I send this tweet now, that'll definitely make sure that people will stop contacting me. Like, this tweet now will stop all of the contact, I'm sure. They'll see the error of their ways and it'll just be
like 1,000 replies underneath saying, oh, you know, class from a Liverpool fan, and like hand-clapping emoji. No, that's not what's after happening here.
Yeah.
So it's not great. You know, as to whether Guardiola's going to even stay, I think this is really bad for him. This is a really bad situation because it's sort of farcical. You know, it's like the quarterfinals.
Yeah.
We can't get past the quarterfinals. All that, after all that, all the big talk, all this and all that. And then once again, you sort of flub it. It's not even like an unlucky defeat this time. It's just what was that? You can sort of see, so even just on social media, the City fans turning on Pep, you know, there's a bit of a what have you done for me lately, Pep, going on. But if you look at the team, just doesn't really seem that happy. Like, they haven't hit the heights this season at all. You know, after two brilliant years, you know, they're breaking records, won two brilliant titles, 199 points in two seasons. This season's been really mediocre. A lot of players have been poor. You know, Sterling's been good, but obviously his season has the worst ending of all. De Bruyne has had a great season, but it's counted for nothing. Lots of other players have not played well. Have gone backwards. You know what I mean? So that's a bad sign. Can he sort of turn this around? He's never really seemed to me like a guy who, I don't know, is he able to really turn this around? There's something a little bit. I think this thing might have run its course. Of course, you know, there's a possibility of refreshing the team, bringing in good players. But already, you know, Ferran Torres, okay. You know, young player, probably not going to start that many games next season. Nathan Ake, like, is he going to take them back to the top? You know, I don't know. Maybe back to Barcelona. Maybe that's where he needs to go.
That would be an interesting summation of this weekend's activity.
What we really need is Pep Guardiola.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I don't think it's gonna happen.
Pulls back the curtain. Yeah.
So what was the last one? The United. That Lindelof Fernandez. You know, I think the content of it was basically, how did you not clear that, you prick? And you know, it got deflected, you twat. See, it seemed like that was basically the disagreement. You know, Fernandez afterwards said it's nothing, it's football, it's normal. It's like, well, it's not that normal, actually. You don't see it that often. It did look bad. I think it looked worse than it was from Lindelof's point of view, in the fact that the cross did take a little deflection, and that does make a difference. It did, because it did look as though Lindelof had just left the center of the 6-yard line totally unguarded, which would have been bad defending. But it wasn't quite like that. What can you really say?
Yeah, I mean, it does exist very much in the shadow of Friday night and Saturday night, because really, like, were many people actually expecting Man United to beat Sevilla? Like, this Man United team, like the same Man United team that we've been watching since the end of lockdown, who looked really, really tired like 3 or 4 weeks ago, to actually beat a team like Sevilla, who, you know, are a lot more experienced at this level.
I didn't really have a strong impression either way before the game. You know, Sevilla are obviously the masters of the Europa League, so it's not really a surprise in any sense that they managed to win the game. I saw Paul Scholes afterwards talking about just signed Sancho or whatever. A Man United supporting friend of mine was making the point, look, you know, this, what was it like in January? It was sign Harry Kane. Not from Scholes, but, you know, from, wasn't it Keane? It was Keane. Just go get Kane. That's all you need to do. And it's like last night, it's like, you know, they lose immediately. It's like United have to spend money. And it's A, they've spent loads of money. And B, like, once you sign that player, all that's going to happen is the next time they lose a game, you'll say they need to spend more money. You know what I mean? It's just like, I don't know. But look, a lot done for Manchester United. More to do. I know Alan's birthday.
20th of April?
No, that's Hitler and Shay Given. Gotcha. And Steve Finnan.
And my mum.
McDavid is the 12th of April, which is easy to remember because of it's the...
Dave Letterman.
The Titanic. 68 years after it disappeared beneath the icy waves.
Yeah.
Owen McDevitt was born.
Circle of life, man.
Is there anyone alive out there? Can anyone hear me?
It's Tuesday, 4th of February. We're nicely into February now. Let me just have a look at some of the birthdays today. Comedian Dara O'Brien, TV presenter as well. Listen, he hosted Have I Got News Here, some of those programs. 48 years old today. Ex-boxer. I have to admit, I'm not really sure about this man. Oscar De La Hoya. I don't know. I can't remember him off the top of my head. Anyway, he is 47 today. Sports journalist and writer and radio personality Ken Early is 41 today. Irish actor Patrick Bergen is 69 today. Now, Patrick Bergen, you might...
Well, we're joined by Raphael Honigstein and Miguel Delaney. Raphael, I want to ask you first of all, I mean, now that the Champions League has become this kind of weird Franco-German friendship trophy... in the last, the semi-final, there's three German coaches in the last four. Is this some kind of a high watermark? You know, Pep has been dismissed, Simeone is gone, Messi, Ronaldo are yesterday's men. The future is black, red, and gold.
I wouldn't go that far. I think if there's one common denominator or one narrative that you would maybe identify, is that the three German coaches involved really learned their trade as youth coaches. They weren't classic superstar coaches. They weren't big players. Yes, Hansi Flick played for Bayern in the 80s, but he was a squad player really, and then had a very limited coaching career. And I guess what it says is that the Bundesliga is a place where you can get by not necessarily being a big name, if what you do with the actual coaching, how you relate to players, the kind of ideas you can get across, if they're strong enough, you get chances without having the status necessarily. And I guess that's the only thing I can say. But I can easily envisage a Champions League last four where Leipzig and PSG don't make it for whatever reason. And then we have a very different discussion.
Okay. Well, I mean, in one sense, what happened in the Manchester City game is not that big of a story. You know, City lost the kind of team they've been losing to all season. But in that's one way of looking at it. I mean, the other way of looking at it is that this is an absolutely defining moment in the career of Pep Guardiola. I've seen a few people making this point. Your colleague at The Athletic, Michael Cox, I think Raphael had a piece saying, you know, he's never failed like this before. He's never chickened out before in the way that we saw last night. You know, by picking a team that was too cautious, too defensive, has big match conservatism. It gets them all in the end, including Guardiola.
Yeah, it is quite curious. I mean, I think Guardiola is often misunderstood as a manager who wants to attack all the time. I think deep down he's actually a defensive manager, but his idea of defending is with the ball. And by playing in the opposition half and just not letting them many opportunities. And he has an obsession with being in control and with trying to control the opposition and not expose his own team. And I think in this particular case, judging from what he said afterwards, he just went a little bit too far the other way. He seemed to think that the only way to stop this amazing Lyon counterattack was to really abandon much of the principles of their own game in the first half. And it took his team the best part of the first half before they got anywhere near to the point where they had some kind of sense of rhythm and understanding of what they were supposed to do. And Lyon just absolutely loved it. I mean, Lyon just played in this line of five. De Bruyne was kind of just standing around with his back to goal for most of the time, not going anywhere. The wing backs that City had were very reluctant to come forward. I mean, it was just really strange, undercooked performance. And of course, City have so much quality that they can change halfway through the game. And if you replay the game 10 times, I would say that even with the mistakes, City will probably get away with it. But on this occasion, they didn't. And I think Pep is partially to blame, but just not helping his team playing to their strengths.
How big a deal do you think it is, Miguel? I mean, is it a case where Guardiola can turn around and sort of shrug and say, you know, that's football? I mean, that's just the kind of thing what happens, or is it bigger than that?
It felt like he was attempting to go down that line in this press conference afterwards. It was Rafi's colleague at The Athletic, Adam Crafton, that asked him the question, particularly about when he introduced the idea of this formation to the team. And he was initially a bit evasive, and then... you know, had that comment that's kind of done the rounds now, which is tactics are not the most important thing at this level, which is quite convenient for a man whose tactics have been very influential in the final result. I mean, I think it's probably true that City, even last night, or even Saturday night, they did enough to win the game. You know, it's a different story if Jesus takes that chance or Sterling equalises. But I think what's key to all that is Guardiola's approach basically reduced the gap between Lyon and Manchester City. And it is a considerable gap, given one is possibly the most lucrative project in the history of football, and the other are seventh in Ligue 1. I mean, as a friend said to me, if he showed that respect to Lyon, what would he do to the firepower of Reims, not Nice and Lille?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was literally just as Rafi was talking about, you know, the Lyon counterattack, I was thinking, you know, were they really that much scarier than, say, Crystal Palace? You know what I mean? And I was actually looking up the Crystal Palace Man City result, and he just plays 4-3-3 against Crystal Palace. They've got, you know, Zaha, they've got Schlupp, they've got IU, you know. He doesn't sort of change everything. He just goes out, plays the normal game and wins easily.
Well, is that possibly some of the mental conditioning of Pep in this regard? I know Rafi's written about this in the past, particularly in relation to Bayern. But, I mean, over the course of a league season, even though he'll make kind of micro or cosmetic changes to his team, there's mostly the kind of broad idea. And sometimes they'll get caught out. It's just, when they're on particularly good form, and players are at their top level, like 2017-18 or 2018-19, they'll get caught out much less. That hasn't been the case this season. But usually he'll go with it, because over the long term of a league season, you know, mathematically, it's going to work out that City will win more games than they won't, or that their quality will out. But you would wonder, given the kind of sudden death nature of the Champions League, given the complex about the competition that he would have grown up with, as, I mean, you know, everyone's seen that famous image of him as a ball boy when Barca overcame Gothenburg in 1986, you know, the 3-0 recovery. And this was at a point when Barca had never won the trophy, and it was, you know, so uniquely identified at Real Madrid in Spain. And then given what the first few years as a management entailed and all the difficulties had in the competition since, whether this just scrambles his brain a little bit or forces him into second-guessing himself just too much. I mean, because I think a lot of the times, even in some of the eliminations of the past years where he has received criticism, you can still understand what he's doing. And some of them were genuinely down to freak results or freak occasions. But for this, it's a lot harder to pin on that, and it just looks as if a pattern is developing.
Yeah, and Rafa, I think that the thing that was really surprising just at the beginning of the game is just to see the team and to see both of the Silvas, Riyad Mahrez and Phil Foden all on the bench, and I thought, okay, that's a bit strange, you know, to see them all left out is strange. If you go through them one by one, I guess David Silva is, you know, is obviously coming to the very end of his, well, he's now finished as a Man City player. I'm not sure he's ever been totally convinced by Mahrez. And obviously Foden, you know, is the most talented young player he's ever coached, whatever, but it's still a young player. Bernardo Silva, do we know what has happened between these guys? I mean, Guardiola does sort of go off players. I mean, obviously, Leroy Sané is a case of this, where everyone else is like, wow, what an amazing player. How lucky are Man City to have this guy. And actually, it turns out Guardiola isn't happy with certain aspects of what he's doing. And, you know, he's gone now. Bernardo Silva just seemed like an absolute dream player for Guardiola. And the way that he talked about him was absolute, passionate love. And suddenly, now he doesn't even get off the bench. He doesn't even get off the bench again like this. What is going on?
Yeah, it is strange. I mean, I have no idea if and what happened between them. But you're right in saying that Guardiola, I think, can go off a player when he feels that the player, for whatever reason, doesn't understand what it is he's supposed to do or is too risky in his game. And while you were talking, I was thinking back to the game at Spurs. In the first leg, where Guardiola went also with a very defensive lineup. And at the time, I think he was just beginning to kind of fall out of love with Sané. And I think the Sané issue was that Sané was just trying to do stuff that had carried with it a lot of risk. And Guardiola just didn't feel he could afford a guy that would lose the ball. That's why he went for Mahrez, who was just much safer in his distribution. Much more often check back and look for the midfield rather than take on one or two players down the line the way Sané did. And yesterday was kind of an extreme version of that in a way. You know, no players between the lines, no individualists, a very stodgy kind of square midfield, very one-dimensional. And maybe the idea was, or I guess the idea was, that defensively we'll just be solid. And then maybe later on when Lyon start tiring and, you know, we've sort of pressurized them and pinned them back, then we bring on the players that make a difference. Maybe he was inspired by the PSG game in some weird way because, you know, PSG changed the game, I guess, eventually in the end when they brought on their attacking players, their number 10s, and of course Mbappe, which was not available to Manchester City. But it seemed to me that the fact that there was no second leg kind of exacerbated this, maybe you want to call it fear, but at least concern that City would somehow make a mistake. And in his attempt to nullify and to mitigate these possible mistakes, he just swung far too much in the other direction. In my
just on that, Rafi, I'd be curious as to your opinion to this, and it comes back to one of the questions Ken asked at the top, because it does feel increasingly in football, and I think this is probably down to German culture as well, that all of the major tactical innovations now are taking place in the Bundesliga. It's influencing a lot of the game more than anywhere else. And even, I mean, not that the championship is a standard, but the very fact that, say, the most progressive clubs in England second tier are those with Germanic coaches that have followed this model, you know, it kind of points to a potential evolution. And, like, I've obviously spent the last few days, I was talking to a few people at Red Bull, and talking about the kind of almost the coaching school that Rangnick initiated there, which has obviously gone to a next level. But is there a slight danger, I wonder, of, not that Guardiola is falling behind in the way we talk about Jose Mourinho, but that, because I know he's obviously been in the Bundesliga and took on some kind of, added a directness to his game that wasn't previously there, but whether he stayed a bit truer to a kind of possession conservatism that maybe isn't quite a total cutting edge anymore, given that how much this kind of Germanic game is based on almost sharper edges.
And for me, that's not the issue, because I felt that when he moved to the Premier League, City was that perfect blend. I mean, City was Barcelona 2.0, yeah. Keeping the ball, winning the ball back, but also able to exert pace and space into the final third without necessarily having that sterile tiki-taka that he himself doesn't like, possession where the ball just goes from one side to the pitch via the midfielder to the other and then back again, the U he calls it, where it's just, you just don't go anywhere. I felt that City, at the very best, were a blend of everything that's good and cutting edge about football. So I wouldn't say that, but what I think is perhaps more relevant is that when he went to Germany, he would spend every single press conference telling the reporters how good the opposition were and how important it was to cut down on the counterattacks. That the counterattacks was the most difficult thing for him to deal with in Germany, and that he spent a lot of time trying to work out how you can play that high line, play that, you know, that possession game, that pressing game without being exposed. And it just got me thinking that, you know, he seemed to be kind of almost stuck in this, oh, you know, these counterattacks, what I'm going to do.
The forwards of Wolverhampton, this type of...
adding that third centre-back seemed to him like a logical solution, but in effect, just took away far too much from City's own game too.
You said there was one word in what you just said there, Rafa, which absolutely captured my attention, and that word was Barcelona. They also were involved in a game over the weekend. It's a pretty big game, a big moment in the history of the club, I think. Now, I have a question for both of you, because, you know, the issues with Barcelona, there's so much of it here. It's been such a kind of a multi-year tragedy with so many dimensions and aspects that, you know, it would take all week to sit here and talk through them all. So I'm just going to focus on one aspect of this. Say you were taking over Barcelona now as a sort of an all-powerful coach / sporting director figure, like a Cruyffian dictator who, with absolute license to mold the club to your will within, you know, realistic economic parameters. You know, you don't have infinite money. You've got to deal with the players as they currently are, and so on and so forth. What are you going to do with Lionel Messi? Is he part of your plans? If you're playing him in the team, where do you play him? Or are you going to make it a condition in your negotiations with Barcelona board that by the time you turn up there, Messi's got to be gone. You got to get rid of this guy. I'm going to ask you first, Rafael, what are you going to do with Messi in your revamp Barcelona?
As a new Barcelona coach, let me tell you, Ken, but Messi's not the problem. Messi's part of the solution. He's the one player that turns up. He's the one player that carried us over the last few months in all competitions. And I will try everything in my power to get the best out of Messi. But I think there are some players around him who are no longer quite at the same standard. And I will try to promote younger players. I'll try to sell some of these players who haven't worked out and use the cash to freshen up this team and to buy a lot more quality that Messi would be happy with and will bring out the best of him.
Okay,
Thank you for trusting me with this job.
I like your answer. I like your answer. Okay, so you're saying it's not Messi, it's all his mates. It's all the mates that he insists on filling the team with that are causing us the problem here. Miguel, what about you?
You won't find a bigger Messi fan than I. He's a player I love more than anyone else. But to play devil's advocate, if you're a new manager coming into that, or if I'm a new manager coming into that job, one of the problems that Messi now represents is that he exerts such a gravitational force, both on the team, but also on the wage bill. So if you need to restructure that squad, which Barca do, it's very difficult while there's this basically monolith on the books. And that is kind of complemented by the fact, evidently, as brilliant as Messi is, I think he's probably the best player of all time, you can evidently win Champions Leagues without him, and with teams can win it without that level of star player. You don't have to look at Liverpool or the potential winners this season if it isn't PSG.
But you haven't told me what you're doing with him yet. You haven't told me yet. Is the axe coming down? Is the Delaney axe falling? Or are you saying, no, I want him in my team and I'm going to play him in, I'm not sure what position. I mean, what exactly are you going to do with this 33-year-old best player that there's ever been, but for how much longer nobody can really be sure.
well, the rational side of me almost wants to get rid of Messi and thinks there's a lot of arguments to do so, especially if you're restructuring. And I mean, the other side of that is Messi is such a presence, not necessarily that he's a dictator or anything like that himself, but he is still such a presence that he will create a little bit of difficulty for any manager that wants to be a complete authority into himself.
Yes.
But the emotional side of me, I'd be with Rafi, I think I'd try to get the best out of him. I mean, he's such, because he's unique.
But realistically, that is what is going to have to happen, because no manager can come in. You know, when we talk about players being bigger than the club, in this case, it's true. He is bigger than the club, and he will continue to be, you know, for as long as he's there, and he's kind of earned the status, and that's reality. No manager is going to come into Barcelona now and say, well, you know, you've had a good run, but now it's time to go. It's just not going to happen. The circumstances of the way this season has ended, with the empty stadiums and, you know, the 8-2, it's unthinkable that Messi will not still be there when the crowds are back in the stadiums. You know, he's not going anywhere, Rafael, is surely the thing. So the question is, do we now arrive at a point where we see what the problem really has been? I agree with you that Lionel Messi is not the problem, but it does seem to me as though maybe he is, in a certain sense. Maybe the problem is that there's too many of the guys he likes, he's been playing with for years, who he wants in the team. I'm thinking of Busquets and Suarez, most obviously, maybe Pique. I don't really know what Arturo Vidal's status is vis-a-vis him. I find it mystifying that he's there. But if you want to have Messi, it seems you must surround him with some players who are going to run, because you know he's not going to do that. And Barcelona at the moment have four or five who can't do it.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, despite of everything I just said at my first press conference, I think behind the scenes, it would be worth establishing if there is a market for Messi. If you can get 250 million euros for him, or 200, or even 180, and you can make it look as if it's his decision rather than yours, then that was something I'd be pursuing as a coach secretly. But I'm not sure there is a realistic possibility, even with the rumors about Inter being interested and at Man City before. I just don't see it happening in this market. So you're going to be stuck with Messi, and you'll be stuck with a team that doesn't have a lot of money coming in. Unless you find solutions to offload these guys. If I can just move it on beyond Messi for a second, I think Barcelona have had a problem from on two levels here since they last won the Champions League, or you could say maybe even before. One is that Guardiola set a benchmark, a blueprint that became so iconic that Barcelona decided as a club, just as they had done with Cruyff before, everybody now must really play that football, which narrows down your choices of management and makes it very difficult for anyone coming in, because they're just going to be a copy or a clone of Guardiola. And if they do things differently, and even if it's successful, like Luis Enrique did, you'd be seen as not quite fully doing your job. So that's the first problem. And I think Barcelona have to move beyond that. The second problem is that they've really just botched. They've botched this transition. We've seen all the big clubs deal with it. Bayern have taken a bit of time, but they've eventually got it right. Juventus are in the process of it. I think Real Madrid are in the process of it. Barcelona have done it very, very badly. They've sold Neymar, who could have been the Messi in waiting, and they bought three players who haven't worked out, who haven't helped the team at all. Maybe it's not always their fault, but it just hasn't worked. And they find themselves minus 400 million euros and no money to invest. I think that is the bigger issue.
I mean, what you're saying, I think there's a lot to it, Rafael. But I have to say that if Barcelona had maybe this idea that they're a bit too much in love with themselves or with this kind of idea of what the Guardiola years were, and you know that's kind of the template, and if it's not that, then it's kind of worthless. And the point about Luis Enrique and his extremely successful and extremely good Barcelona team is well made. You know that even though by a lot of measures they were better than the Guardiola team, they never got the same sort of credit. But they have forgotten one aspect of the Guardiola thing, which was this intense pressing all over the field. Everybody was, that team ran everybody off the field, in addition to, you know, playing that the type of football that people hadn't seen before. They had more energy, they applied more intensity to the game. And Barcelona completely lost that. They may have this idea that they're sticking by this principle, but they'd forgotten really what that game was all about. If they had actually stuck to those principles, they wouldn't be where they are now.
Yeah, but you can't do it with the players that you have at the moment. I mean, there's just absolutely no way you can play pressing game with the midfield that they have, and with absolutely no width on the flanks and no pace. I mean, it's just impossible. Mm-hmm. But again, I think that points to the muddled and totally misguided recruitment policy that they've been following.
Well, that's what someone who has worked with the club told me. When Setien was appointed, they've appointed an ideology manager in the way that Rafi described there, someone that has to follow these kind of Pep principles, but under the delusion that they still play that way and still have a squad built for that when they patently don't. They have a complete mismatch of a squad with players that don't see what they're supposed to do. And even if we look at the signings, they've gone from kind of big signings to utterly bizarre signings. I think we said it here a few weeks ago, but the team you could make out of some of Barca's signings in the last half decade alone, from your Vermaelens to Paulinho to Braithwaite, it's all and whatever they do now, it's at best a kind of a really kind of faded facsimile of the Guardiola idea. I don't think they look anything like that at all.
Yes, but you know they also signed some good players. I mean, you know, Coutinho, Griezmann, Dembele. Like, these are not bad players, but all of them have been failures. You know, they've all failed to integrate. This is a team that hasn't been able to integrate anybody new for, it seems like, several seasons. I mean, is Suarez the last one to really stick, the last really big player to come in and be like, yeah, you know, this guy feels like he should be part of this team. It seems to be really difficult for good players to make any impact there.
Well, Rakitic as well, to be fair. It's Rakitic, and it's basically that summer of 2014.
He's 2014 as well, though, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. The last, which is the last time they won the Champions League that season, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, I think to a certain degree, though, Setien summed it up. Setien, for all his issues there, and there's a lot of fair arguments over whether he's the right kind of quality for Barcelona, whatever about principles. But, I mean, he articulated recently that Griezmann is basically a player who can't play in a 4-3-3 when that is supposedly Barca's staple formation. And obviously, a lot of the last few weeks has been trying to figure out how you get him into that. I mean, and you couldn't have a greater indication of the entire dysfunction of the club than that.
Yeah. Although, you know, Rafael, one of the things, and we, you know, I know we have to wrap it up here, but one of the obviously a much commented upon aspect of the game was that Barcelona's record signing scored two goals for Bayern in the last few minutes of the game. But maybe the more significant former Barcelona player in that Bayern team was the one playing at the base of midfield, Thiago. Is there an argument that this Barcelona, where Barcelona are now, that the seeds of this were sown in 2013 when they somehow managed to let Thiago join Bayern for, I think it was like 18 million euros, when he was worth a lot more than that? Because I guess at the time they didn't want to cut down Xavi's playing time. They had this legend. I mean, sure, he was maybe a little bit past it, but like, they botched that succession. They, you know, Thiago should have been integrated at that point. He never was. They let go of him, and now here they are with Arturo Vidal charging around in their midfield, and Thiago, who should be playing for them, is instead running the demolition job for Bayern.
Well, they also have Frankie de Jong, who's, you know, a pretty decent player. And
another player who doesn't seem to be able to integrate, I guess. But yeah,
I think he'll get there eventually. I think it's a bit too easy to blame Thiago's departure for what happened since. He was cheap because he hadn't had enough game time, and therefore a release clause kicked in, and Bayern and Pep were able to extricate him. But he's been injured quite a lot. He hasn't always been that important a figure for Bayern as he has been maybe over the last 8 months or so. But as an indication or sort of epitome of the wider point, I completely agree. They're still trying to basically reinvent the core of the team that won all these things, and it hasn't happened. And every year they look a little bit more tired, and the players who've come in have done absolutely nothing to bring Barcelona back to that next level. So the recruitment policy has been all over the place. I think managerial-wise, they made a few bad decisions. And this is the richest club in the world now. This is a club that will turn over 800 million euros this season to take over absolutely everyone. And I think about 530 million or so of that is spent on this team, which doesn't really buy you a lot by the...
Well, it's phenomenal. I mean, I've seen those figures as well. It's like what the average wage, like, for the 25 first team players is like 20 million euros. Like, how do you spend 500 million euros on a squad of like 25 players? I mean, obviously Messi's taking most of it, but even if he's taking like 100 mil, it still seems like there's a lot of obscenely overpaid players there.
Yeah, and I think ultimately that is the most important thing. I think if you don't manage your recruitment at this level, if you make too many mistakes or buy players who might have been right, but for whatever reason just don't work out, then eventually you run into the problems that Barcelona have had and or are having now. And, you know, we hear about the money issues. They are stretched already with percentage-wise about the money that they spend in turnover. Then without the additional income, or without some of the income that will be lost this season, it ties your hands. And I think that this transition, this need to reinvest, has just really come at the worst possible time for them. Okay, but it'll be a bit of an eye-opener.
Okay, just very lastly, the two of you, both, I want to get your predictions. Who's going to be in the final and who do you think will win the Champions League?
I'll go Leipzig-Bayern final, Bayern to win.
I don't have a problem with that.
You mean you agree that that's what's likely to happen, or you enthusiastically you hope that's what's likely to happen?
I'd be very happy if that would that would happen. I mean, I've been underplaying Bayern's chances all season, and I still believe that they'll be tested more severely than they have been, probably by PSG.
You think PSG will beat Leipzig?
I think they will. Yeah.
The only thing about that is, I thought what was. And I'm basically writing about this. Atalanta pushed PSG very close. And like Gasperini alluded to this after the game, because Atalanta basically have an idea of football that's kind of impossible at a club like PSG. And I think Leipzig have that again to a greater level with better players than Atalanta. And I think that makes it basically a 50-50 game. And I just don't know, gut makes me fancy Leipzig.
Okay, well, it will be revealed this week. Rafael Hornstein and Miguel Delaney, thanks a million for talking to us on the show today.
Never forget the true nature of this city. Listen, you screwheads. Here is a man who would not take it anymore. A man who stood up against the scum, the dogs, the filth. Here is someone who stood up.
And this bike, by the way, I'd only had for 2 weeks. What happened to it? Dublin happened to it. Dublin has kicked the shit out of the bike.
There was a few minutes when I blithely believed that I lived in a civilized city. I arrived home. It was already dark. There was rain and mud everywhere.
Oh my God, this town!
So I thought to myself, no need to drag my bike through the house, given that all I'm doing is, you know, getting changed and getting myself and going to the pool. So I'll just leave it here beside the front door. Not on the street. I was in the house for probably for 8 to 10 minutes.
What tobacco is it? I don't know. I haven't put tobacco in ages. Just give me some.
And there's nobody on the street. And it's dark. And there's not even any foot traffic. Open the door. Bike's gone.
Oh my God, this town!
It's actually been taken from outside my front door in an 8 minute period of being unguarded. And this bike, by the way, I'd only had for 2 weeks. This bike was given to me by my brother.
Oh my God, this town!
And I'm thinking, why? What happened to it? Dublin happened to it.
Never forget the true nature of this city.
I was very impressed by Rafa's first press conference as Barcelona director of football there, Ken.
He's good. He's good at that, isn't he?
I was like, I could just imagine all of the Barcelona fans being both calmed but also enthused by, you know, like, steady hand on the tiller. I like this guy. He knows what he's doing.
And thirdly, deceived, because he was all the time hatching a Machiavellian plot to get Messi out the back door. You know, just working at a lot of levels. Like, it's not like I told him, not like I said to him, well, listen, you know, like a press officer style briefing. They'll probably ask you about what you're going to do with Messi. I just sprung it on him, and he was
just
ready
immediately
to go.
Went into football administrator mode. I was,
you know,
impressed.
You know, he pulled me up on a grammatical error earlier on in the day.
In your German or in your English?
In my English.
That's got to say. Well, first of all, I mean, I have such faith in your grammatical skill, Ken, that I'm going to ask, was he correct? Like, you know, was your grammar actually incorrect?
It was. What happened was, I'll tell you, I wrote to him. I said, basically, it was something like, listen, I was wondering if you would be available to talk to myself and Miguel about the blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, okay. And, we sorted out the thing. And then he just said, P.S., why do you use myself incorrectly? Expect it better from you. I said, I was like, what? And then I was looking, I said, talk to myself and Miguel. And I was like, is that wrong? Rafi says, sorry, it's an irrational pet hate of mine, along with paninis.
Oh, so he goes in and orders a panino.
One panino, two panini.
Mani panini.
Yes, wow. you don't say paninis. So I was like, oh my God, yeah, I've been exposed to speaking patois by this
you should
German.
Have, you should have told him it was Ulster Scots, Ken.
Well, but,
you're insulted by culture there.
But it's just like, I think it's some kind of like weird, like Irish English, like, you know, that sort of the way that we're like too polite or whatever. Mm. You know, just some sort of forelock tugging, sir, you know,
yeah.
Would you mind speaking it all to myself? And, you know, like, just say me.
Yeah.
Don't say myself. Like, why are you trying to sound posher than you are? Like, it's all you do is make yourself sound like an idiot. Like, the new Barcelona manager's first press conference was going well until he took issue with the grammar in one of the questions of a reporter, and it descended into lesson learned. And I hope for a few of you out there as well, I've helped you to avoid the pitfall, because at least Raphael Honigstein was up front. At least Raphael Honigstein said, look, you've done this and I don't like it, and I'd like an explanation. Whereas I don't know how many times I've done that and I've just been silently judged by people who have forever thought a little bit less of me but never said so. You know, and which would you rather?
Oh, I'd rather the honesty, Ken, of course. Okay, that's pretty much it. I want to thank you sincerely, Ken.
Thank you, Ken, too, Murph.
Ken and myself will be back tomorrow on the World Service. And don't forget, it's football, football, football all week. See you later.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, they never go home, they never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine, it's not that at all. It's the opposite of that, it's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.